boom, Blackpink in your area. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Hillary Clinton's birthday, and since I'm banned on Twitter, I would like all of you, and I'll say this again later when more people trickle in. Well, first of all, that was Megyn Kelly. If you saw the start of the stream, the hot lady in the black lingerie, Megyn Kelly, Republican, voting for Trump, kicked off the air because on Halloween she wore blackface one time. Stupid. Anyway, it is Hillary Clinton's birthday, and so I would love all of you to go on Twitter with a picture of the 2016 electoral map, which was mostly red, and post it, tag Hillary Clinton, and say happy birthday. All of you. I want, like, there's 74, but we'll probably get 800, 1,000, so I'll say it again. Go find the 2016 electoral map. Just go into, like, Google Images, 2016 map, whatever. Post it on Twitter, tag Hillary Clinton, and tell her happy birthday from Ryan Dawson. I can't because I'm banned. But anyway, my brother's riding shotgun. We're going to do some Civil War Navy history. Well, World Navy history, I ought to say. And so as the title says, it says, what did I write? The first ironclad battle, something like that. This was the first actual battle between ironclad ships. Been wooden ships before that. Now, there was an arms race between the French and the little weenies that lived north of France. I'm just kidding. The French and the British had started building ironclads, but they had not used them in warfare yet. And they didn't have turning turret or the sloped or any of the things that would come from the Americas. The Americas kind of figured it out because of the pressure of the Civil War. So, I'll set the stage, and I'm going to give it over to my brother to explain the Battle of Hampton Roads, but the South, I believe, made the first, but Union with all the industry copied and made more, and Lincoln basically inherited most of the Navy, and the South was trying to convert merchant marine ships into battleships on the fly. Lincoln had already put a blockade on the states that had seceded. And South Carolina said, up yours. We're not paying this export tax. And so they fired on Fort Sumter. Sort of a, not, it was, no one died except for people who misfired and killed themselves. It was just a, say, an act of saying, we're not paying this. Because that fort was there to collect the new export taxes, I mean. And South Carolina wanted a free trade zone and said no. Lincoln puts a big naval blockade out there, and so Virginia and North Carolina also secede, because you can't blockade your own states. And so Hampton Roads is there in Virginia, and the North wanted that. They were trying to protect the capital, so this is very important for the war and for the geography, and everybody thought the North, with so many ships and so much industry, is going to dominate, but they underestimated the ingenuity and innovation of the South. So that brings us to the point of the first ironclad ships. The CSS Virginia, also called the Merrimack, would go on a nice run. But I'll hand it over to Scott to talk about the Merrimack first, I suppose, and then up to the Battle of Hampton Roads.
Okay, sure. Two names is because there was a wooden vessel, a very good one, called the Merrimack, that was at Norfolk Naval Yard. And Norfolk has the largest Navy base in the world today, and it had a large Navy base back then as well. It's in Virginia. And when Virginia seceded, the Navy tried to get all their ships out of the Navy Yard before, you know, the Virginians stormed in and took over it. And the ones that they couldn't, they burned. And they burned the Merrimack, but a lot of that ship was underwater. It only burned to the waterline, so the hull and the main part of the ship was still there. And when the South got into the Naval Yard, they repaired what was left of the Merrimack and added all this armor on and renamed it the Virginia. And it was probably the most fierce ship for either Navy for the entire war. They kind of put all their bread in one basket, and they had over 100 blacksmiths work on it round the clock, overtime for no pay, to make this beast of a ship to go into Hampton Roads, or the Chesapeake Bay, as it's called, and where the best of the Northern Fleet was at anchor in Hampton Roads, because it's protecting the approaches to Washington, D.C., and Baltimore, and other major cities in the north. So, yeah, that's where the battle is going to take place, and it's actually a two-day battle. And what happened is, before the battle began, is if you see on the map, kind of the James River, the south still held that, and the southern banks, like where Norfolk is and Portsmouth and that area up near Swell's Point, was all in Confederate hands. And in the northern part of the bay, where Hampton Roads and Newport News are today, and Fort Monroe is still standing today, that was all controlled by the north, like immediately. So
Pause for a second.
The bay is kind of...
We got a fat Andrew Jackson from Brett. It says Dawson Squared. Pop, pop. You got to say pop, pop.
Pop, pop. Pop, pop. He saw that video. So the Dawsons, myself and Ryan, had a relative on the Virginia. He was a lieutenant. His name was Charles Hasker. And he's going to be positioned in the bow of the ship.
That's the front.
So they had, and this is very rare for the South, they had 8 rifled cannons. And they were all, 4 of them on the port side and 4 on the starboard side. And they were 9-inch guns. So they're big rifled cannon. And the South had very few of those in the beginning of the war. They had 2 7-inch guns, one in the bow, which Charles Hasker was manning, and one in the stern. But they had 3 different ports they could stick them out of. They were pivot guns. So they could go straight in front or 45 to the starboard side or 45-degree angle to the port side. And they don't pack as big of a punch as the ones on the port and starboard, the big 9-inchers. But a 7-inch gun is still enough to rip through wood. The armor was basically metal plates that had bolts that went through them, and then they had 2 feet of oak on the other side. So they had very thick wood on the other side of this metal plate that was on it, and it was sloped at a 33-degree angle, which tanks use today because of this. And they tested it briefly, and they fired some shots, and it bounced off, and they found that glancing blow really helped rather than just
like a lance on a shield.
And they covered the entire ship with tallow, so it looked black, and that would make things slip off of it too a little more easily. And it just looked like a big monster, and instead of that gray color that it's usually depicted as, it was actually pitch black like tar. And the smokestack was black.
Big black is scary. That's what she said.
Yeah, they weren't really going for stealth so much. It was more just to make the shots slip off more easily. And crew of over 300 people, 45 Marines. There's a lot of guys in there. The powder bags are like sandbags. It takes an enormous amount of gunpowder to fire every single shot. And they didn't have a whole lot of it, so they didn't do much testing. They kind of fired each gun once, and it worked, and that was good enough. So the Virginia was actually built in Norfolk, and it has to go up this really shallow – it's not really shallow, but for this giant ship, it's a shallow river, the Elizabeth River, and it couldn't do it. It had to get towed. And one of the little boats that hooked up the cables and towed it was called the Beaufort. And it's interesting because – the captain of the Beaufort was the old captain of the Minnesota, which is one of the Union fleet's best ships, and he defected to the South. He will later found the College of Maryland after the war, University of Maryland. His name was William Parker. So he's on this crappy tugboat called the Beaufort, and he'd already seen a lot of action off of Hatteras and a couple of other battles. And his old crew is out there on the Minnesota on the out in
which was a target of the Merrimack. Yeah.
The Merrimack, which the Merrimack, which had been burned, was the twin sister ship of the Minnesota. So when they were both wooden ships, the Minnesota and the Merrimack were the same. They're over 200 feet long. And they added all this armor and these rifle guns to it. But the Minnesota had over 40 cannons. So 40 cannons versus, you know,
10 with 8 rifles. Yeah.
10. But they're all rifled. They're all rifled. Even the 7-inches were rifled. And the Minnesota had plenty of rifle cannons. Also out in the bay was the USS Congress, which had 50 guns. It was huge, but it was made out of wood. And then the captain, the flagship of the Atlantic Squadron, was called the Cumberland. And the guys on the Cumberland were badasses. They'd been all over the world fighting in the Mediterranean and all over the place before the Civil War. So these are like the most experienced guys. And the Cumberland's not as big as the Congress or the Minnesota, but it is very well manned. It has good crew on it. And you've also got the St. Lawrence, the Roanoke, a bunch of other big ships. And they've all got over 40 cannons apiece.
Yeah.
All of them are, except the Virginia, right? And then you got this little ship called the Beaufort, which is a tugboat, which has no armor, is wooden, and has one cannon. And it's going to go right into the thick of this battle, towing the Virginia. Behind the Virginia, you have the Raleigh, which
was that captain related to Wade Reed? In,
no, but William Reed at this point is on the Arkansas. He's at this point in his career. This is early in the war. So the Raleigh and the Beaufort had both seen some action at Hatteras. They both had one cannon each. Mostly what they had done in their career was pirate Union merchant ships, and they did take, I think, 21 Union vessels together with another ship called the Winslow. And so they had some experience at least, you know, doing that, and they had fought at the Battle of Hatteras and Roanoke. And they're here with the Virginia with one cannon each, and they're going out to fight these ships that have 50 cannons, 40 cannons, and you got the land batteries at Fort Monroe and at Hampton Roads itself. Okay, little history here. One of the I'll get to this later. There's some history between the Beaufort and one of the land batteries. Don't let me forget. So they tow the Virginia out, and they see the laundry is draped all over the deck of the USS Cumberland. So they are not expecting this fight. And very quickly, they see all that laundry getting pulled up, and they see the cables being slipped, and the sails dropped, and the cannons run out. And the Cumberland is very quickly, because it has a good crew and very experienced Marines on it, gets ready for battle when they see the Virginia coming. And as the Virginia is steaming straight for the Cumberland, as they want to ram it and sink it and take those guys out as quickly as possible, they have to pass by the Congress. And as they do, they say hello and fire a broadside into the Congress. And it just rips right through all that wood. And, of course, the Congress, with 50 guns, starts to fire back, and it bounces off harmlessly. So the Congress flees, or tries to. It tries to just go back to the protection of Fort Monroe. But the Congress, being such a big, fat ship, it runs aground as the Virginia attacked as the tide was dropping. And so it's stuck. Now, it can still fire its cannons, but it can't maneuver. And the Cumberland tries to get out of the way as well, but they can't. And Charles Hasker fires the first shot into the Cumberland, and it was devastating. It hit the boiler because they had steam and sails, and it exploded with steam and killed 14 people in one shot. And the guys in the Cumberland are doing all they can, firing at the Virginia, but it's just bouncing off, doing nothing. And they do manage to hit one of the cannons that's sticking out and break a few inches off the barrel, but it still worked. It wasn't as accurate, but that's about the only damage they did, other than riddle some holes in the smokestack. But they fought, and the Virginia rammed the Cumberland, and this ram that they hit them with itself weighed 1,500 pounds, just the ram. So it went straight through. They're only going about 5 knots or about 7 miles an hour. But with all that weight and inertia, it just cracked the ship in half. And the Cumberland will sink, but where it sank wasn't that deep. So it'll sit there the rest of the battle with its three masts sticking out of the water at a 45-degree angle. 121 people on the Cumberland died. And they continued to fight. They climbed up the mast, some of the guys, and fired with rifles and sidearms, which did nothing. But they, you got to give a little credit and testament to the men of the Cumberland to be so brave. And the Virginia decided to let them live because of that, as they weren't doing anything. They couldn't even hear it inside. It was as quiet as, sitting inside your house. So it wasn't rattling the ship, pistols, which didn't do shit. So they turned their attention to the Congress. They fought really well, too. They couldn't ram the Congress because it was in really shallow water, and Virginia didn't want to get stuck also. So they just stayed in the deep water and blasted with their – they could only bring four guns to bear at a time. So they brought their broadside in and just started unloading on the Congress. They took out all 50 guns of the Congress before it surrendered, and a lot of people died. The Congress, when it did surrender, the Virginia couldn't sail up to it or motor up to it to collect the prisoners because it was in too shallow of water. So they sent the Beaufort, and the Beaufort had a little history with one of the land batteries, the 20th Indiana, which was at Hampton Roads, and the battle, a comical battle called the Chickamauga Races, where they chased the guys.
Didn't you write a book about
bombed
that?
Bombed and then landed and chased the guys from the 20th Indiana from Rodanthe, North Carolina, all the way to Buxton, which is over 20 miles. 12 guys from the 20th Indiana died of heat exhaustion running on a super hot day down an open beach in the sand. And they hated the guys from the Beaufort, and they were pissed. So even though it was
Did you write a book about that incident? Because, Mosquito Fleet?
Yeah, that's in the Mosquito Fleet book that I wrote called The Mosquito Fleet of Hatteras.
I'm going to put a link to that at the end because it's pretty interesting too.
It is. That's a whole other side story, but when they saw the guys from the Beaufort, and a couple of the guys from Virginia got on the Beaufort and sailed over to
accept the surrender. This is like smokestack number six.
This is kind of like that. Well, the guys from the Congress have been jumping into water to try to get off the ship, and it's March 8th, so that's as cold as it gets. The water's actually colder in March than it is in January in Virginia. I don't feel like explaining why, but anyway, the land battery started firing. Even though they were collecting prisoners off the Congress, they ended up killing four Yankees. They ended up killing their own men because they were trying to shoot the guys on the Beaufort, but they're collecting these prisoners, and they ended up hitting their own men. And the poor guys on the Congress had to suffer for this. The Virginia lobbed a couple of exploding shells the 20th Indiana's way and scattered them, but then they heated up solid shot in the furnace till it was glowing red and orange, and fired it into the side of the Congress, which made it catch on fire. And eventually, about midnight, just before midnight, the Congress exploded. And I think in total, 181 people died on that ship.
Isn't it kind of satisfying to say the Congress exploded?
Yeah. Yeah. So you lost 121 men off the Cumberland, plus the ship is completely sunk. And then 181 guys off of the Congress, and it exploded. Mm-hmm. And then all of the other Union ships fled and went under the protections of Fort Monroe, but also shallow water where the Virginia couldn't reach them. But the Virginia could still shoot them. So the Minnesota, which is the old ship that William Parker, who's on the Beaufort, used to command, it was the next closest ship, and they ran aground trying to run away, and the Virginia starts shooting the Minnesota. One of the land batteries for the south at Swell's Point had a really lucky shot because they were very far away. They had to arc as high as they could, and they shot a fly ball that hit right in the main mast and cracked the main mast in half. The Minnesota caught
have
on
you ever,
fire.
Did I ever show you that video of that guy in Yemen? He's got like a World War II era bazooka, and with no guidance system or anything, just kind of eyeballing it, and shoots it like 800 yards. It is, it lands right under the fucking belly of a armored Saudi vehicle and blows it on its side. That That's guy, awesome. He was the no, Larry Bird of that. Bazookas. Just, whoo, it was like, go moving, you know, because this thing's just propelled. It's got no guide. And just, bam, it was perfect. And the dude, he's not all. Wearing shoes or anything. He's like barefoot in rags with his bazooka. He just kind of puts the bazooka down and walks away like, whatever, you know. It's thug life as it gets.
Somebody filmed it?
Yeah.
It's awesome. I love the internet because of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So the Congress is done, the Cumberland's done, the Minnesota's run aground and is getting messed up a little bit. St. Lawrence and the Roanoke are taking a few shells because the Raleigh and the Beaufort could get close because they're a lot smaller. But they only had one cannon each, but they're in the thick of it doing what damage they can and harassing people. And anyway, a tugboat comes out to try to save the Minnesota called the Dragon, and they sank that. So now the North's lost three ships. I don't remember how many people died on the tugboat, but only 19 guys were killed on the Minnesota. So they got out of Dodge. They just kind of left the ship there with, you know, after a while and fled to the fort because they couldn't do anything. They saw all the shells bouncing off of the Virginia and they knew it was hopeless. Now, the North knew that the South was building the Virginia. There's spies everywhere. There are hardly any well-kept secrets in this war. So they had made their own ironclad, the Monitor, which only had one cannon, but it fired 170 pounds.
Later.
Well, they'll have
double the turret, of them, yeah.
But this one had a rotating turret, and almost the entire ship
that was innovative too,
was
wasn't
underwater.
It? Mostly ships could just put guns on all sides, but this could swivel. Pretty high tech.
This could swivel in a 360. They had swivel guns before that could pivot, but not in a 360 on a ship. So this one could, and the entire ship was underwater except the smokestack and this big, you know, turret on the top. That they called it a cheese wheel, the South did. And they were towing it down from New York to Hampton Roads, and the Virginia just went out a day early and fucked up their navy.
Pause for a second. So I put a picture up there. The ship on the left with the turret, that is the Monitor. And then the one on the right with like the triangle little house on top, that is the Virginia or the Merrimack. You can tell it's got the flag of the CSA there and the flag of the Union. Flag of the terrorists.
Yeah, ironically, the Monitor would sink off of Hatteras in a storm later. So, which is ironic. There's a lot of ties between Hatteras Island and the Battle of Hampton Roads and the crews and the ships. The Minnesota had been involved in bombing Hatteras, and the guys from the Raleigh and the Beaufort fought against them there and again at Roanoke. It's the third time they fought the Minnesota. And they really wanted to sink it because it had done a lot of damage.
Nice Ron Paul
down
shirt,
in the Carolinas.
By the way. We have three Shekel chats that have come in. One's from Rendezvous Psychology, spelled with a K. Question, do you think Trump will be the last president of the United States? Will there be a civil war? Let me answer that when we're done.
I say no.
He's not going to be the last president. I mean, he's going to be president again. And they're going to have a meltdown, chimp out, and get arrested. That's all that's going to happen. Alvaro for €3 says, I love these Civil War videos. Can you recommend me any books on the Civil War and Satan? Lincoln. Sorry. I thought it said Satan. Red Pilling My
Father. Can I answer that?
Yeah, hold on. Wait. He's got more. Red Pilling My Father-in-Law. So books are better than videos. He is an old boomer. Much love from Spain. I got a bunch of books on the shelf behind me and also on my website. I've got recommended books. I'm going to guess that Scott is going to recommend some of the same things, but if you're going with Charles Adams.
Well, I wasn't going to recommend my own book, actually. My own book is kind of neat for it's just about the fighting, really, the Mosquito Fleet of Hatteras. But on Lincoln, yeah, Thomas DeLorenzo's Lincoln Unmasked is the best one I've ever read. Lee Scruggs, Uncivil War is another good one.
Mike Scruggs, right. I think you went by on that one.
Yeah. the Confederate Navy by Philip Van Doren Stern, which is an old one but a good one. William Trotter's Ironclads and Columbians is another good one. And if you really get, I don't know if you're, I mean, if you really, really want to know what went down, you got to bite the bullet and get the big Shelby Foote set. It's it'll take a couple years to read, but he's a good writer. And
I think he has some audiobooks too. But if you want, if you're interested in like causes of the Civil War, what a turd Lincoln and all his surrounding cabinet were, you should get Charles Adams' book. It's called When in the Course of Human Events. It's arguing the case for Southern secession. That's a good one. And you should just have him read Lincoln's own words, right? And read what his Secretary of Treasury was saying. He created a department to try to deport African Americans to South America. And it's endless.
And did deport them to Liberia.
And he did send some to the Caribbean.
But anyway,
all
back
of them
to this.
Died, by the way. Yeah, I like Charles Adams, Shelby Foote. But if you want some good books, like on General Lee, the best, the ones right behind me right here. This, do you have this?
I can't see.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a Robert E. Lee Reader by Stanley E. Horn. Do I have this on the camera? This is good. Still smells like my granddad's house. This is good. And then, anyway, I'll answer that later. Like, when Scott's talking, I'll start pulling out books, because I got a bunch behind me. Most of my books are in North Carolina. I didn't bring them all to Japan, because I'd already read them. But anyway,
right.
Those are good. Good question. Two more questions, and we'll get back to the history. Let's see. Okay. The Geezer 30. Good evening from England, lads. Here's 25 notes for the pleasure. Ryan, perhaps get in touch with Atwood, see if he'll have Scott on to talk about the Lost Colony. History is not his remit,
yes.
But it could be a good place to start getting traction and notice Scott's work in England. Cheers, smashing work. I think it is the Lost Colony story isn't just history. It's also a conspiracy in a sense that here's one of the most pivotal historical events, you know, the first English-speaking people in the Americas, and it just got buried and forgotten and replaced by Jamestown. So you can see the politicking there with King James. And we're like, oh, the Virginia colony is the first colony. And then we've got the Rockefellers by Colonial
and
Williamsburg.
And that got buried by Plymouth Rock after the Civil
War. Right. And so you've got, people in England wouldn't know this, but maybe. There's this huge outdoor museum called Colonial Williamsburg, or CW. It's really great. Like, you go and it's got historical actors. It's 1753 every day. You can see the governor's palace and the garden and so on. It's right adjacent to the College of William and Mary, which is a lot of history and with U.S. presidents and so on. But it's owned by the Rockefellers. So they have a vested interest in being the first, because being the second colony just doesn't sound good. You know, like, gotta be number one. Jamestown is not the oldest colony. Not the oldest successful colony either. So anyway, I think the conspiracy angle and the missing history and all would be very interesting to Atwood's audience if he wants to take a break from the Epsteins and all that. And if he'll do it, I will go and I will give him the cliff notes on the dirty meeting of the newly released documents, because no one's done that yet. And I've been so busy with the Trump-Biden stuff that, you know, I wrote about it, but I haven't really done any videos, so I'll give it to Atwood. We'll see if we can do that. And then the Geezer gives another extra five and says, where did the original inspiration for the development of the Ironclad come from? Was it from European shipyards or wholly insular engineering evolution in the Americas, northern or southern shipyards?
Liverpool was probably the best at it. Mm-hmm. They had Ironclads forever. It's just this is the first time two of them fought each other. And this is the first time that
they... It
wasn't
that widespread, though. Like, France and England had been making them, but they never used them in combat. They didn't have a 360 turret. They didn't have the slope. So, like, part of it's original American engineering, but as far as, like, can you have a boat made of metal and it doesn't sink, the Europeans have been doing that for a while.
And they'd done it in Americas before, too, but not...
Only for about 30 years.
They fought each other. Yeah. Right. So the best naval yard in the world at constructing ships was in Liverpool in England, without question. Nothing in the north or the south down in the United States could touch the industry in England at the time. But anyway, so
South Korea had a really good navy as well.
Yeah. The first day of the battle's over, and the Congress exploded, the Cumberland is rammed and sunk, the little tugboat Dragon's gone, the main mast of Minnesota's been snapped, it's still run aground, and despite trying all night long, they cannot get it off the bar. The St. Lawrence and the Roanoke took some casualties, a bunch of little smaller ships, a bunch of people died in the land batteries from the 20th Indiana. It's a pretty good day for the South. They lost two guys and 21 wounded, and all of which were when they were getting the prisoners from the Congress and were fired on under a flag of truce. Another
very
four Yankees
Yankee
were killed
to
that too. Yeah. Well, both. Yeah. Yeah. Both sides.
Is that a dog
that
or a
time.
Democrat yelling back there?
It's my dog. Okay. Sorry, man. I can't.
It's all right.
Do anything about it.
I just want to make a joke about Democrats.
Yeah.
Anybody supporting Biden
so
at this point is
battle.
Just you. Why? He made the 1994 crime bill and stuck all these black people mostly in prison for like minor infractions, and his own kids are smoking crack and banging hookers and doing whatever they want. F the Bidens. Anyway, so you got damage. You got the Cumberland run aground, chopped in half with the ram. You got the Congress out. You got the Dragon, which is a great name for a tugboat. Dragon, get it?
Yeah.
You got a bunch of Yankee ships down, and you've got a land battery that with personal beef. It's a little bit sweet revenge, and you had the mast broken off the Minnesota, but it did get away.
No, it didn't get away. It's stuck in the
well,
mud.
Well, it's got away from it. It didn't get taken, is what I mean. They're in shallow water.
So if you pull that map up again, what the Virginia did is they went to the Confederate land battery at Swell's Point and anchored there for the night, got more gunpowder, let the wounded off, whatever. The goal the next day, because they could see the signals from the Yankees all night long trying to get the Minnesota off the bar, was to destroy the Minnesota. That was their next goal. And they knew they couldn't get close enough to just really pour it into the sides. So they kind of had to do some long-range artillery, but that's fine. They planned to do that the next morning, and that's what they did. So
they had to wait for the tides, too.
They had to wait on that, and they went out at dawn, and the little Beaufort and the Raleigh are right there with them. And there's a bunch of little pesky Yankee ships as well that were fighting. The railing of the Beaufort was shot away. It had a little wooden railing. Minor damage at those two ships. And they come out the next morning and they start sticking it to the Minnesota and it catches fire and Minnesota's firing back and it's worthless. It's just bouncing off the sides. But very, very, very early, the Monitor finally shows up and is immediately sent into battle. And they didn't even know what it was because he's just this round cheese box with a cannon sticking out and a little trail of smoke because almost the whole ship was underwater, which protected it. And it had even thicker armor than the Virginia did. And it had its one cannon fired a 170-pound shot. So I used to blacksmith, and the anvil that I was pounding on was 150 pounds. And I remember thinking, wow, they're firing a shot that weighed 20 pounds more than this anvil every single time they fired it. And that hit the Virginia, and it still did nothing, but they could feel it. It rattled a little bit. The smokestack was completely shot away. They pounded on each other for hours, and they just motored in circles, pounding on each other. And they had the idea that they wanted to take the anchor chains and try to put it into Virginia's propellers and wreck the propellers and make it immobile and then maybe be able to storm over and do some damage that way, throwing hand grenades inside of the ports or what have you. That didn't work. They weren't able to do it. And the Virginia at one point fired a shot that exploded right at the little pilot hole where the Lieutenant Warden or Wooden, who's got some relatives in Hampton Roads today on that run radio shows, Bob something FM whatever. Anyway, it exploded.
Did I tell you when I crank called them one time? I got a story later.
Let me. Yeah,
me and Lindsay got them good.
There you go. So, the monitor drifted out of the fight because their pilot was blind. And it took him a while to get and rattled pretty bad, you know. The other guys came in and it took him a while to understand what was going on. There's a lot of chaos and it, usually you hear like in this exaggeration, like neither ship was able to penetrate the other. It didn't do anything, which isn't true. They had people wounded in both ships, and there were some cracks in armor and some armor plate flew off and on both ships, so they did damage each other some, and they're barely able to move because their smokestacks get shot away because that's like the only thing you can hit that it'll rip through, and so it's hard to get your steam up without that, and so the monitor drifted out of the fight because their pilot was blinded, so they say they didn't retreat, that they went the wrong direction because their pilot was out of commission. So the South claims they won this fight because the monitor retreated first. And when they saw the monitor retreating for Fort Monroe, they went ahead and headed back to Norfolk. Well, once the Union guys got somebody else up into the turret, they turned around and started firing at the Virginia. It's about over anyway, and the Virginia fired back a few times, continued to Norfolk. So the Yankees, oh no, we won because Virginia was fleeing, but the Virginia didn't leave until the monitor left, so whatever. It's generally considered a stalemate. However, if you take the entire two-day battle together as one battle, clearly it's a tactical victory for the South, because the North lost some of their best warships and some of their best Marines died. So, on a strategic point of view, it's also a Southern victory because McClellan, who's in charge of the Northern Army at the time, wanted to take his army by land along the James River and have the Navy follow up the James River and use the Navy support to help him to get to Richmond. And he couldn't do it because the Virginia sat there for months at the mouth of the James River, and nobody dared go near it. So he changed his plan and tried to just cross the rivers in Virginia, the Rappahannock, like, and whatnot.
Is, you know, because it can take all the wooden boats out, runs, and it's right. Like that. Just you're not getting in here. Not with that and the land batteries. Not happening.
Exactly. And we know what happened to McClellan. So that didn't work. And later, Grant would use the same strategy that McClellan had come up with and go up the river from that direction with his army and have naval support. And Lincoln wouldn't let him do it for a year because he said, you can't do that. I'm running for re-election against McClellan, and that's what he argued to do.
Idiot.
And didn't end up doing it. And Lincoln kind of forced his hand and made him go and get his ass kicked. Same thing with Burnside, same thing with Hooker, same thing, you know, over with the revolving door of generals that Lee beat the shit out of. So Grant gets his wish eventually because it's the only thing that's going to work, and that is how they eventually took Richmond. But what happened to Virginia?
I don't think that would have worked when Virginia, they were well the supplied and all, though. Like, a lot of other factors happened before that, you know.
It would have worked better than
what they did, sure.
What Burnside and Hooker did.
Did Burnside have a hard time in Fredericksburg?
Couldn't really be worse. Yeah, he lost 12,000. But you know what?
That's where the word sideburns comes from. People who grow sideburns is from Burnside.
Yep. The word Hooker, like for a whore, comes from Hooker because he had so many whores around him.
I thought that was Hunter.
At any rate, what happened to the Virginia? Yeah. The Virginia, they wanted to take it up the James River, themselves to, and they lightened the armor, and when they did, the bottom of it was exposed, and they knew, crap, you know, now they're, the Union will just descend on this thing quick and sink it. So the South lit it on fire at Craney Island, and when the magazine touched off, it exploded. But before they did that, they got all those nice, juicy rifle cannon off of it, and they took them to a place called Drury's Bluff up the James River. And the Monitor and several other ironclads, the Catalina and a bunch of others I forgot, went up the James River to try to push through. And the crew from the Virginia, including Charles Hasker again, at Drury's Bluff with those good rifle cannons, beat them down bad. There's two battles of Drury's Bluff. This is the first one. And the ironclads got murked, man. They couldn't shoot the guys at Drury's Bluff because it was so high up on a cliff. They weren't designed to, you know,
yeah, it's like
angle up and shoot at a fort. They were designed to shoot level at other ships, or they could arch a little bit, but the guys at Drury's Bluff could just pound them. And they had put torpedoes and obstructions in there, and they had practiced and figured out exactly, okay, when a ship gets to this point, we can all fire and hit it at the same time, where they had certain markers, like hidden markers, that they'd worked out exactly where they needed to elevate their guns at whatever angle to hit there. So when the Northern Army came up, when got to those spots, they unloaded on them. And so the North just turned around and went back to Hampton Roads. So that's the Battle of Drury's Bluff, which is kind of also the same crew of Virginia and some of the same cannons, along with the battery that was already there. And then Charles Hasker would later be reassigned, and he was on the Hunley, which is the first submarine. They got in there with a hand-cranked propeller, if you can imagine.
That's Hasker again.
And it sank while he was in it. Yeah, Hasker again. And the hatch closed on his foot as it sank, and he was dragged 42 feet to the bottom. And then he was able to free himself and swim up to the top.
The weight came as they
he had some ear trouble from that,
and the other guys that went down died.
Yeah, they were sitting at the top, and it was actually a Confederate ship coming into the harbor, created a big wake, and it poured water into the hatches, and they started sinking and couldn't do anything about it. And it as people scrambled out, a couple people escaped, and he almost escaped, and the hatch closed on him. He could feel people's hands trying to push his foot out. And when it filled with water and kind of, you know, depressurized, whatever you call it, he was able to lift the hatch and get free. He's the only one that went to the bottom and came back up. The Hunley sank three times. The third time it sank was it killed its entire crew. That's the famous one that sank. The Housatonic, yeah. They only killed five people, but they did sink a ship, so it's the first time.
A boat, though.
Yeah, the entire blockade moved a mile further out after that. Gave them a little breathing room. That was so late in the war, it was just they did it just to do it, because they'd spent so much time. They had to hunt. They had another submarine called the Pioneer in New Orleans before the Hunley, so it's not the first submarine. And the Yankees had one, too. But it was the first submarine to be used in combat in sink a ship was the Hunley. And it was the same crew from the Pioneer. A lot of them were the same
year,
guys.
I know the British were working on a sub. Didn't get it to go, though. And the Koreans made a sub, but didn't use it in combat. It's weird how a lot of things, like the
airplane, the South actually did
it. New Zealand, the same time as North Carolina, are invented at the same.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so on that note, McClintock from Ohio, he was working on the Hunley. He was a Southern sympathizer. He made the diving fins that were on the side and how to operate them that would make the sub go up and down while it was underwater. And then they had a hand crank propeller to go forward. The Wright brothers, who did the airplane here in Kill Devil Hills, studied that. And that's what they used to make the airplane go up and down, the same design. This comes from a submarine from another guy from Ohio who came to the South and became great. McClintock. Anyway, that's the story of the Monitor and Mary Mac battle. And
Graveyard of the Atlantic off Hatteras.
Off of Hatteras. They're towing it to Charleston, actually. They were trying to take it to South Carolina, and a storm hit. I think 16 of them drowned. Some of them washed up. Some of the bodies washed up at Hatteras Island, and they're buried somewhere. Our great-great-grandfather, C.C. Miller, was part of the burial detail, and grandmother told me where they were buried, but I didn't try to dig them up or anything. I'm not going to do that, but supposedly in Buxton near the Coast Guard base. All right. Well,
don't tell people that.
Whatever.
We've got some from UW Chad for 25. That is a Jackson and five Washingtons. You notice which currency I never say. I just say five Washingtons.
Yeah.
Or two Jeffersons and one Washington. Well, anyway, they say, no need to interrupt. I'm just showing some support for the Civil War stream. So thank you very much, UW Chad. Horace Cock Johnson says, I was about to ask you guys why I was taught the commie tanks of World War II were the first to use sloped armor. I know, stupid question. Love these shows. Well, I don't know why someone taught you that. Probably because they like communism and they're dumb. I don't know. But tanks in World War II, I don't know which one was first, the T-34.
There's the Virginia with its sloped armor.
We're talking about. That's true. Talking about tanks. The German T-34 used it in Barbarossa, and the French had a tank with sloped armor, at least in the back. No. What was it? The Char B1? Whatever. Like Charles. Charlemagne. I mean, Char, whatever. It was the Char B1, I think. Yeah, the French had a tank. The Germans had a tank before the communists. That's the point. And they used sloped armor. And it was, now, most of the other German tanks after T-34 would also have sloped armor, except for the Tiger, for some reason. And I don't feel like getting into what their ideology was. But anyway, it was not the commies.
This is the Mosquito Fleet, Hatteras Island. Is an easy read. And it's all about the naval battles in North Carolina and Virginia. And it's got the Battle of Hampton Roads is included in it. It's a single chapter, but I was just looking in it, and the North ended up losing over 300 men killed in the 2-day total. The South lost 26 people.
26.
History is written by the winners, so when you hear that a battle was a draw, you know who really won. Kind of like the Battle of the Wilderness is considered a draw a lot of times. The Union Army lost 18,000 people.
The South and then back for Winter Harvest. And they're like, ah, you lost ground. We win. Just write it in the paper. Just put it like that.
Yeah. Spotsylvania and the Wilderness, Grant lost 18,000 men at each one. And Lee lost 9,000 and 10,000. So you're losing twice as many guys. And you've got twice as many guys. So you should murk the other side. But he didn't. Then these guys were not in a fort. They weren't defending. They met, marched right into each other at the Wilderness in the woods, and the North got destroyed in that battle. It's really sad. People burned to death. There were all kinds of fires set because the woods were dry and so thick. He did. And at Spotsylvania, the South did have some trenches there, and but they were like hastily made, and they're still outnumbered 2-1, and it's a sad war. Like, the whole thing is creating a nation of cripples, of legless, and twice as many people died of disease from living in these filthy camps as on the battlefield. You're talking about together 600,000 Yankees died and 400,000 Confederates, so that's million people killed in combat.
As of last year, they're saying a lot more than that. Those have been the figures for a while, but they're discovering more died in the Civil War than had previously been thought.
There's so many little unknown skirmishes, you know.
See, it really adds up. especially the civilian casualties. Think, look at a case of like
another 50,000, for example.
12,000 Yankees starved to death. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we did a show on prisons before, and Andersonville was the worst, but the next seven worst but were all in the north.
Those could have been supplied. But what the point I wanted to make is at Andersonville, because of Sherman burning, you know, everything, you had people starving to death. They offered to return them. Lincoln said no because he wanted to burden them with having to take care of them. But people started dying of typhus and typhoid and the same things as happened in another war at another event. Because when you start getting malnourished, you start to die from stuff that usually your immune system can fight off. And then it spread throughout the camp. Anyway.
It's a sad, sad, and very avoidable war. The good thing about it is slavery did end. Even though that wasn't the objective going in, and I know you know this, the way I always say, hey, if slavery ended for the wrong reason, who cares? At least something good came out of that war.
And it didn't really end. I mean, it didn't officially end on paper until the 13th Amendment, which didn't happen until after Lincoln was dead. And it still didn't really, because people got paid in script. And then they went and enslaved the Chinese, murdered Native Americans, and they started paying blacks and Irish with, you know, monopoly money. So I wouldn't say slavery really ended until like the 1920s with the Blair Mountain Rebellion and so on. Now, the cattle slavery ended. It got phased out in steps. Jefferson ended the transatlantic slave trade. That was a big step. He almost ended all slavery in Virginia. He lost by one vote. But it slowly started getting phased out.
He kept it out of the Northwest.
So it was getting phased out anyway. So I don't feel like going into the whole thing, but we got some good questions. The Geezer and Andre.
Ryan, I gotta say, like, even though Lincoln was not an abolitionist and he was an asshole and whatever, there were actual abolitionists. Like, the General Upton for the North was one of them, and there was a movement in the South as well. There were abolitionists in both sides that did truly, you know, care. They set up freeman colonies to try to teach skills like reading and writing. There was one on Hatteras Island called Hotel de Afrique. So there was, I mean, even though Lincoln wasn't one of them, there was an abolitionist movement.
That was something that was going on
that
anyway.
That was not tied to politics.
That overlapped the time period. But the reasons they went to war were real clear. It was a banker's war, just like every other freaking war.
It's about tariffs.
I know. Sorry. Geezer 30 for 5 says, what's your top three picks for Confederate generals? Make it top five for more choice if you want. You can also include lesser officers or smaller units like colonels, brigadier captains, and so on, sea captains, etc.
I'll go first. Okay. Number one, Lee, period.
Jackson.
Two, Hoke. General Hoke is one that is... He didn't become a general until late in the war, but he always won. He was very good. And he was with Lee in the Army in Northern Virginia. Of course, Stonewall Jackson was fantastic. I'll do a Lee, Jackson, Hoke. It's hard. There's so many, man. There's so many good ones.
I will say Lee, Jackson, Stewart. Said I could do
Stewart,
any units, right?
For sure.
Do cavalry. Jeb Stewart or, I don't know, Johnson and Beauregard, they're all...
Forrest was good.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
Nathan
tactically,
Forrest.
He won a lot.
We'll talk about doing a lot with little. And he had a black, an all-black cavalry regiment, all his bodyguards. Hard to say, but definitely General Lee. Definitely not Pickett.
Yeah, definitely Lee.
I would pick Jackson. Jackson just, man, because Jackson and Lee work so well together is the other thing. It's how, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a difficult question.
Jackson's kind of the hero of Bull Run. Lee was.
Yeah, yeah, Beauregard there, another good one.
He wasn't even there, but Lee, He's good. Yeah. There's a lot of good ones.
I know the ancestor of Johnston. Met him in person and everything. You've heard this story, but the audience hasn't. So, in Japan, of all places, there's this guy called Tall Paul. Tall Paul is like 6'7", and he looks like Edge from WWE in the face. Except I think I don't even think Edge is that tall. And he's from Canada, just like Edge. And he is related to the Southern soldier that accidentally shot Stonewall Jackson. And he had some more details that I did not know. Passed on orally, like what happened. He said, they say who it is. She said, Stonewall Jackson. They said, yeah, right. They shot into the dark. Hit him in the arm and so on. So, in Misaki, Osaka, this is where this happened. Tall Paul got on his knees and took the slap. Because he told me that story. We were drinking Chuhai till like 3 in the morning. And we were going to something the next day for work. And I was like, man, like, you need this. So I gave him a fat right hand across the face. And he just took it because of what his ancestor did. Slight revenge for Stonewall Jackson.
Stump.
I cold cocked him, dude.
Longstreet was also shot by... North Carolina troops shot Jackson and Longstreet.
I know. Well, that's because most of the reserves were all Carolina.
And Longstreet lived, but...
But Scott, check this out. It was almost to the day.
They shot people than any other...
It was October 26th. Shillery's birthday, right? October 26, 27 in Japan, because it was like 3 a.m., so maybe it was 27 here, but it was on Hillary's birthday, because I always tweet out that 2016 map on her birthday, except for now, because I'm banned. But it was, I remember it also because it's the same day Jim Leahy died from Trailer Park Boys. May he rest in peace. Got any Jim Leahy fans? Press 5. He is the liquor. I am the liquor. Anyway, I slapped the guy. I slapped the ancestor of Stonewall Jackson. Apparently, most of the family lives in Canada now. One of them lives in Japan, and he's really tall. Okay. DJ Cogdill. Wait, did I miss one? Oh, no, I missed one. I missed two of them. Sorry. The Geezer 30 says, would you both...
Hasker's on the Virginia.
Yeah, Hasker's on the Virginia and helped build the Hunley. So. And then he started a box company in Richmond. Geezer 30s.
He burned it. He's the one that lit the match.
I know. Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. I should tell everyone else that. Sorry. Would you both concur that the Civil War of the 1860s was the Second Civil War? The War of 1876, as I see it, was essentially a Civil War. Well, yeah, I mean, the Revolutionary War was a Civil War because it was all part of Britain, right? It was the colonies.
You mean 1776?
That's what he said the Second Civil War. So there's one of 1776 and one of 1860s, is what he's saying. Yeah, it was a civil war where the West seceded, I guess, from the king. So, the Revolutionary War was a secessionist movement because the colonies broke away from the crown, and you could consider that a civil war. I think the... distance and all, and cultural differences, they were already kind of distinctly different nations. Where they thought of them as like, you know, proper England and the colonies, right? The colonies are just the colonies. They weren't considered part of the motherland or whatever. Well, that was a mistake. So, yeah, two civil wars. And the wrong side won both times. Just kidding. you got to hand it to Washington and those guys. But, you know, one of the better generals in the Revolutionary War is Benedict Arnold, and he changed sides. But until Lafayette and others, the French really helped the Americans in the First Civil War. So, yeah, it was insurrection, you could say. But since they won, then it's not insurrection. It's a rebellion. It's a revolution. Anyway. Were there any other civil wars between
them? General Hoke is... You hear a lot about Lee.
There was a war between... A quick 7-day war between Maryland and Virginia that Virginia won. That's sort of a civil war. Were there any other state versus state things between the 1860s and 1700s? Kind of the creation of Texas with Tennessee.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of little in. Well,
I had to think on it anyway. DJ Cogdill says, "Hey, Rye, I got both your books and Why Peace, and I can't wait to read them. I'm also gonna be upset if Tim Pool doesn't have you on because he's having Vosh on tonight, who can't mention Tim in his own videos without insulting him. He is just he just wants perspective from a leftist point of view. Vosh is a commie that supports bestiality, and he refused to debate me because I would annihilate that guy. Yeah, he supports bestiality. He's a communist, and he's becoming a Holocaust denier. He's completely worthless. He saw that I had a bit shoot. He's like, I guarantee you this guy is some sort of white supremacist that supports government intervention. He's not a libertarian. I'm like, I don't even want there to be a federal government. But yeah, it's all based on because he's at the bit shoot, because everybody who gets banned goes to bit shoot, right? And that means we're all a bunch of white supremacists, whatever. Has to wear a Native American hat. And I'm married to an Asian. I have mixed race kids. Fire Pixie for 25 says, hello, I'm a SOB from the Outer Banks. I've since moved to South Carolina, and everything that I'm hearing, I've heard from the old timers, but never in books. And not too much in school either. I've heard it referred to a few times as the War of Northern Aggression, but mostly the uprising of the South. Slaves is all I hear about. Part of my dissertation in college, actually.
There are some books, including this one.
That's true. Hey, there's Mosquito Fleet. You can grab that off Amazon. Right? I put the link in the description already.
It's cheap, too. This book doesn't cost very much.
What does it cost? Let's see. I'll have to hit my own link here. Hold on.
I don't know.
On Amazon, $12 for new. That's cheap. Yeah, $11.98, whatever. History always is colored by the present. So if you look at a history of pirates,
whoever won.
It's whoever won, but it's also colored by whatever's going on currently. So pirates were marauders at sea. Most of them starved to death, were not successful. They pillaged, raped, murdered, and robbed. There's nothing cool or glorious about them. But during the civil rights era, or during, you know, struggles between classes and or women's suffrage and stuff, they're like, oh, pirates were rebelling proletariats against the rich elite, and they were anarchists at sea, and blah, blah, blah. Or pirates were egalitarian because they had Native Americans and blacks in their crew, which they did, because a thief is egalitarian. They take anybody, you know. But it's like, that is not why they were pirates, you know. But it's whatever's going on in the present, they push that on the past, like that's what was important back then. So during the 1960s, during the civil rights era, suddenly the 1860s became all about slavery, even though it wasn't. But that's how they wanted to color it, because that's what they were talking about then. And so if you have like a resource war from whatever, you know, they'll want to paint that and go, oh yeah, all the previous ones, it was like this too. And it just isn't so. You have to look at it the way people were thinking and writing about back then and what was important to them back then, not what's important to you. You know, you don't take it and go, oh, it was about this because that's what I want to talk about. That is a really big flaw in a lot of historians or people who aren't historians who think about history. It's like always colored by whatever they happen to be currently into and interested in. And, you know, it's almost never like that.
The best thing to do is look at what was going on. You got to look at what was going on before the war.
Yep.
You know, or before whatever event you're talking about. But that's true with every American war. They're not going to say the Spanish-American War was imperialism.
They're not going to say Iraq was for Israel. They're going to say,
you know, the winners always write the history, and they were never wrong.
And we are just supporting the moderate rebels. I mean, they lie about every war, including the World Wars and the Civil War. They lied about Iraq, they lied about Syria, lied about Libya. Like, why the hell did we bomb Libya and give it to Al-Qaeda?
Right.
Because Gaddafi what? They don't even have a good excuse, right? Well, we know why they really did, but what's the excuse? Why did Obama and Biden invade Libya and make slavery great again? What was the point in murdering all those people and toppling a functional government?
Yeah. Well, hey, Ryan, I'm going to go catch some waves. It's overhead and barreling, and it's fun. And why not? There's still some Yankee ironclads sitting out on the Outer Banks that you can view today.
All right, I'll catch you later.
Yeah, but if you like this Battle of Hampton Roads and you want to hear a lot of the naval history, it is Mosquito Fleet of Hatteras.
In the side chat, for those watching live, I'll put it in the, as the top comment. And I will add it to the description. It'll be MP3 on ANC Report in a little bit.
Right on. And I wrote it 20 years ago.
Yep.
So, you know, I was reading it today to get ready for this, and I was like, man, I would never do that much research right now. It's hard. But not on that topic. But, yeah, it's harder when you have kids. But I went through and read every single captain and lieutenant on every single ship in that battle at one point. And I don't show out like when I'm talking on here and get that deep into it, because that's just showing off. You just want to get the meat of the story out, really. And if people want to know all the rest of that crap, you can buy the book.
You know what's happening in 6 days?
I could, but no one wants to sit through that. What's happening in 6 days?
No, that's in less
election.
Than
Oh.
Wow, it's already the 28th. 6 is the election. 9 days. Sorry. 9 days will be the newest Dawson baby doll. COVID's over. The 4th, and then my new baby comes on the 6th. So that'll be the youngest Dawson baby doll.
Right.
I get it, baby doll. DAW. I thought Ashton's baby was going to be
his
the youngest.
His name's Thor, right?
But don't talk about my kids' names on the stream because I got lots of haters. But that's a rumor. It's just baby doll for now. So we'll see. It is a he, though. 9 days for a new Dawson, and 6 days to Trump's reelection, and 6 days to the great meltdown. We're going to call it the great meltdown. Someone wrote Dawson 2024. Sounds pretty good. Scott, I'll let you go.
No way.
I'll hang up for you. All right, he is now gone. I've got Skype lit up with a whole bunch of messages, so something happened. I will go look at that later. Horace Cock Johnson says, should have had this when he was here. Have you guys ever read the alternate history books by Harry Turtledove, beginning with the Confederacy winning? If so, what are your opinions? The last book was Up to World War II and Black Americans Became Marxists. Sound familiar? It's white Americans becoming Marxists. I mean, let's be clear. It's Portland. It's all these little shit libs. It's a bunch of losers. I have not read them. I have heard about it. I'm not into what if stuff. I don't care. I'm into what ifs. Chuck U. Farley says, just a little love for the Dawson brothers, and sends a 5 George Washingtons. I'm not going to say his name. I say high five most of the time. The winner of the stream is The Geezer and UW Chad, taking first and second place. Fire Pixie. And then I believe it was Horace Cock Johnson pulling in for bronze. And Rendezvous Psychology also with the 25. And then there's Brett Bucks down there. Just missed third place by a 5. Oh, wait. Somebody just came in gold. Chip Thomas just dropped in a General Useless. It says, cheers to the newest Austin. Thank you very much for 50. Man, that makes my day. I was about to bounce, too. I did 4 streams today, and I don't sleep. It is now 5:39 a.m., so I'm not even going to do a commercial. Go get my brother's book if you like naval history and Civil War stuff, or you just want to support a Dawson. There is Mosquito Fleet. It's on Amazon, so it should come quick, COVID or not. It is in the live chat, and it is also the top comment that is pinned. So thank you, Chip Thomas and Chuck U. Farley, Horsecock Johnson, Fire Pixie, who's a regular, DJ Cogdill, The Geezer 30, Andre. Oh, did I get this? How close was European intervention in the Civil War from, let's say, Britain or France? I missed that question when Scott was on, but I'm telling you, we'd have the same answer. Quite close in the beginning from both those nations, actually. But it benefited them for the Americans to tear each other apart, and they were making so much money on insurance and trade because, you know, they're exclusively the only place you could buy. So they were hitting it. But when Lincoln made the Emancipation Proclamation, Europe had just recently gotten rid of slaves itself. And so when they made it appear like that's what they were fighting, what one of the reasons they were fighting for, the public wasn't going to stomach that. It also had a backlash in the North because a lot of the Yankees were like, I'm not fighting for that. And the largest race riots in the history of the United States have happened in New York City in the middle of the Civil War. They call it a draft riot, but these people said, I am not going to fight for no, if you know what I'm saying. In a way, they did give material support, so they're part of the war, but they didn't send in gunboats or anything like that. Russia, as well, got into the Civil War, as well as Native American groups. So it was nearly a world war. And it was over a million people died, which you have to understand, back in the 1860s. That's an enormous percentage of people. Like 2.5% of the entire population perished in the Civil War. So that's pretty bad. And then Chip Thomas comes in for a follow-up three and says, get some rest, take care of the family. You can hear my voice getting hoarse, right? We need you fresh in a week to come. Yep, we got Sam Tripoli on Monday. I've got a lot of election stuff to do. So got to cram it all in and then prepare for the baby. And so my wife's going to be stuck in the hospital with a C-section for a while. So I'll have the other kids. So I'll probably be doing replays of movies I made and stuff that week because I don't know how much I can do live, which sucks because it's going to be right after the election and everything, but it is what it is. So family first, and you guys a second. There's nothing wrong with that. Have a good one. You guys, I hope you like these Civil War streams and sometimes Native American streams. I got an email from a northerner who lives in the battleground, some of the prominent battlegrounds for King Philip's War. So I think they want to come on the stream too. And I could just tell from the email, like, yeah, they know what they're talking about. So I would love to do a stream about King Philip's War with them and my brother and go over that one next. Maybe next, but we're definitely in the near future. But it's going to be after the election. So, guys, ancreport.com. Become a member. $5 a month. You get MP3s and so on. Or more. But for $5 a month, not a day. You know, just 1 month. For $5, you can become a member. You can join the Discord. You can do all that jazz. And it helps really support us out there. Chuck U. Farley says, for the new edition, thank you. I'm getting baby shekels. Well, this is nice. Thank you very much. That's going straight to diapers for the new little one. I'm going to have my handfuls, but I decided, well, let's make some more Dawsons for the next generation. So that is what we're doing. And hopefully we can all visit the U.S. one day once the you-know-what virus is gone. Or, you know, after November 4th when they open things again, because this is a political virus. Maybe we can get down there. I got a new mech film to screen and all this, and wasn't able to do it last year because of Rona. So maybe this year we can have the conference and I can get that screen. Thank you guys so much. That really helps after getting banned on Patreon. So feeling good. And we'll have another Dawson and Dawson next Monday with Sam Tripoli. Peace. Megyn Kelly for no reason.